Well, good afternoon and welcome to our Pop the Question program on a kind of a chillier day. I guess maybe we're not used to this, although we should be. We have with us today, it's a regular at WAVN Radio when he's in the area. And that's Cal Rutstrom. We're very pleased to have you back, Cal.
Yeah, and how'd it happen that you don't have any of the gray hairs, and I've got all the gray hairs, and you and I have been together for years here.
No. When you first met me, maybe I didn't have any, but they're coming on fast, I want you to know. Cal, to our regular listeners, they know him as an author, an outdoorsman, a fellow that has many interests, and I don't know how many books we've discussed over the years, but how many would you have?
Nine say? Now.
Nine? And all of them about the wilderness in one way or another, right?
Yes, either directly or indirectly.
Mm-hmm. And you have a new one that's, I mentioned about 5 minutes to one that maybe it's on the shelf today, but it will be within the next couple of days.
It may be on the shelves now, or it'll be up, be in within a day or two, I think, because they have shipped about a week ago.
Mm-hmm. What's the title of the...
Once Upon a Wilderness. This book is probably a little different from... many of the other books that I've written, and it kind of takes in the whole pattern of the city and the wilderness and man's outlook on life today regarding the better side of life and so forth and so on. So I think this is going to be quite an innovation as far as the average reader is concerned, not only the outdoor person.
Well, there's so much about what you have just said to say that I don't know how you could ever condense it into one volume.
Well, sometimes you even have to have a little skim milk to fill up a book sometimes, but in this case...
but you didn't.
It was very brief, and then, of course, the publisher kind of sits on you to keep it down so that you don't get a book 3 inches thick that you have to sell for a price of a book about an inch thick, you know.
Right.
This is a cost proposition today.
Before we discuss the new book, Once Upon a Wilderness, to those who are joining us possibly for the first time, a little about the author. You have lived in the St. Croix area for a number of years. You've lived in many areas.
Well, we have a rather divided existence. Our principal home, my wife and I, live at Marine on St. Croix, where we've been for many years. And then we take off for Lake Superior when the weather gets too hot to write. When it gets to 95, you can't even have an idea, you know. And then, this is on the shore of Lake Superior, on the Canadian side. And then as we get into the season farther, we head north, about 300 miles north of the boundary into an area that's very wild, because if you don't have a perfect contact or close contact with the wilderness, you're not going to sound very authentic. So we go there for a couple of months, usually about the 1st of August, until it freezes. And then we stay back at Marine for about half of the winter, and we head for the southwest. We are thinking about giving up the place in the southwest and possibly finding something on Vancouver Island in the wintertime in order to write about British Columbia, because British Columbia is pretty much a primitive wilderness yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cal, in your travels, you've traveled, I don't know how many years here now, that's quite a number of miles, I think, if we look at the northern tip all the way back to the southwest. You travel, I suppose, by auto or station wagon. Do you fly at any time?
Well, we don't do much travel by car, except to go to these places, which probably are 1,000 miles or more apart. Once we get into the wilderness, we'll fly into various areas, or we'll travel by canoe or by dog sled, or now by snowmobile. We're getting, of course, addicted to the snowmobile too, because we have to take in the whole pattern of the outdoors in order to convey it to the next fellow, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But Cal, and let's talk for a moment then about the book of Once Upon a Wilderness. Now, you have here many years of experience in the wilderness. You've watched a man growing up in this particular area from the Twin Cities. And we see farms going by the wayside. We see wildlife. Well, we're talking about Save Our St. Croix and all of that. The other day I heard a fisherman talking about the walleyes they caught down near Red Wing were pretty good. He said last year they were so oily you couldn't eat them. And this was natural oil that had been spilled into our rivers. But you've watched all of this, and you have a great concern about the ecology. How do you cover this in the book?
Well, I think most people now who do any thinking at all have a great deal of concern about the wilderness or the outdoors in any respect. And I, of course, have a great concern about it because I've lived with it for so many years. The thing about it is that there is a growing consciousness about this thing, which is reasonably apparent now. I see, even here in Stillwater, I notice Hooley has a dozen barrels out there, yeah, where you can toss your glass and your tin cans and for recycling purposes, so that possibly this thing is going to be pretty universal in time. But the thing about the whole business is that unless we all get conscious about it, unless we forget about trying to settle the whole thing with just a little rhetoric and no action, we're all going to be in a lot of trouble. And the average man in the city, since there are about 70% of the population in the city, gets the feeling that the city is a separate entity from the wilderness. But the natural forces are just as much at work on him as they would be on the man who is 300 miles into the primitive wilderness. In other words, he can't crawl under the bed or get into a closet and keep from growing old. He's going to still grow old, and all the forces are at work on him. And an interesting aspect of this thing is that unless man keeps building and building and maintaining, nature will level everything. The proposition is as soon as you put up a brand new building, it seems to be there permanently, nature goes to work, starts
sandblasting it.
Yes, indeed. And some of the hotels and business buildings went up when I was a kid are now being torn down, or they're being so eroded by nature that they have to get rid of them. So that, in other words, nature, the natural forces are in the city as much as they are out in the wilderness where the tree has fallen and going into decay. In other words, a building starts decaying just as reasonably fast as a tree decays, you know. So the idea is that we are a part of the whole natural world, the processes that are going on, and we better see that we maintain some kind of a wilderness, otherwise we just won't have any cities. Now that sounds rather paradoxical, but it's fact.
They go together. It all does if you look at it with an open mind and the whole picture, right?
Indeed it is.
Let's take your book, Once Upon a Wilderness, chapter headings here. You have one, the Wilderness Today.
Yeah, well, we've just talked about that a little bit, but of course now we think in terms of transportation getting into the wilderness, which is different from what we thought of it in the early days. In other words, it was quite a feat to get 300 miles away from the railroads in the early days by canoe or by dog sled. Now you can fly in there in a comparatively short time, or you can, even in the winter, you can travel in there by snowmobile. But there are certain inhibiting factors that enter into this, which probably helps to preserve the wilderness. In other words, the average man is living a little bit too well. He likes the comforts of a good bed, and he likes fancy foods, and he likes very much inactivity, if he can get along without activity. So that we live only in our wilderness cabin, we live only two short porridges from Sioux Lookout, or we fly in there 25 miles. Now you'd think that accessibility of that kind would allow people to go in there by the hundreds of thousands and getting into the wilderness. But they don't. The average plane flies in there And people will fish for a day or so, and then it'll fly out. And just two portages to go over for most people is difficulty. So we scarcely see anybody passing our cabin there on the very main waterway. Now and then a fisherman will go in there, but he's in there today and probably gone tomorrow or two or three days. So what is helping the wilderness, it may seem like a strange thing to say, but what is helping the wilderness more than anything else is man's love of easy living.
The comfort. Sleeping and having everything with him, I see.
Right.
How do they, we've talked of man here, I suppose this is
man and women.
General term, how about women in the wilderness?
Well, I have a chapter in here called Women in the Wilderness, and my wife and I spend a great deal of time in the wilderness together now. And it is rather interesting. She has a button-pushing residence at Marine on St. Croix, where the heat and the cooking and the whole thing is all automatic. But she adapts herself to the wilderness just as well as she does to the button-pushing home at Marine on St. Croix. In this book, you will see where she's out cooking meals over a fire, and you will see that this fire is properly controlled. It isn't just a bonfire, you know, where they're burning up everything. It's properly controlled. You'll see where the baking of breads and so forth is a very, more or less, a well-regulated and carefully processed undertaking. It isn't this rough kind of camping. And all the way through, she manages just as well there as she does at home. And the average woman who thinks about going into the wilderness, she thinks that this is an ordeal. It's because she doesn't know how to do it. I don't say that this is true of all women. There are a great many women who do know how to do it. And I had a program in a girls' camp for many years. And I found that women did just as well camping as the boys did at that time. There's some things they don't seem to do too well, and that is, one is swing an axe, and I don't know why. They can swing a golf club, but they can't swing an axe.
How about pitching a tent?
They can pitch a tent, and they do very well.
Mm-hmm. Two other headings you have in your book, The Alien Wilderness and the Micro Wilderness.
Well, this, when you speak about the alien wilderness, we're apt to get a little sentimental about our early pioneers, how they came in and they conquered the wilderness, and so on. Actually, if you know the real facts about our early pioneers, they fought the wilderness. They wanted to clear the forest so they could plant their crops, and of course this is natural, they have to make a living. But the situation was pretty much where they were trying to destroy every wilderness factor that they could in order to maintain a domestic and industrial type of existence. And so that, and when you think of 70% of the people living in the cities, I'm sure that the percentage of people who really love and truly understand the wilderness are a great minority.
Mm-hmm. So the wilderness as we know it today and the wilderness of tomorrow, do you have thoughts as to what will become of what we know as the wilderness today?
Well, I say there's a growing consciousness, as I
there
said
is.
Earlier, about preserving the wilderness for two reasons. People who get to know it, of course, find that this probably is the better side of life. They know what the city is doing for them, that we have terrible problems in the city. We've got pollution problems that are absolutely hygienic and sanitary conditions are almost untenable to maintain. And we have situations where the people in the city now are kind of creeping to the suburbs as a class distinction thing. They find that the city no longer becomes that great utopia that they hoped would develop. And so there is a conscience. The second thing is that we cannot survive without maintaining a great wilderness area.
Cal, you've mentioned there is a growing consciousness of it all, and we can't survive without the wilderness. Do you have personal thoughts as to what man is going to do? Do you think he's going to preserve it? Do you think
I was very pessimistic for a long time. I'm getting more optimistic about it now. The thing that, that comes to mind is that we think of the wilderness being destroyed by our present population. There's a question now whether the wilderness elements, the actual natural forces, won't tend to destroy man quicker than we will destroy the wilderness. I don't want to say this as a discouraging factor, but every man, woman, and child on earth today, within probably 100 years, will be wiped from the face of the earth. They won't be here. There will be the babies that are yet to be born will take over this thing. Mm-hmm. So there will probably be an erasing of many things that we have now, and a new pattern placed on the blackboard. And I think that when you see what is going on, I heard a remark last night that in 1980 there will be about 8% less young people.
8% less on Earth?
Young people on Earth than there is now. Young people, that mm-hmm. is. That's because, of course, we're getting around to controlling populations, and there are less babies going to be born now who will be adults in 1980. So the whole thing is changing, and while this youth revolution sort of thing that we have here nowadays with our hippies and all of our beards and all of our protests and so forth, and symbols of protest, are such that maybe this will develop into something really conclusive as far as a better life is concerned.
You know, it's strange, you talked of the beards and the mustachios. I saw a picture the other day. It was about an 1890 photo of several gentlemen standing there. Well, maybe they're 15 or 20. I counted two people in the photograph that didn't have a mustache or a beard. So we did. There was another little thing that evolved there. It went down, you had to be clean shaven. Then it went back the other way. They went back to the old way.
Yes.
History repeats itself.
It seems now that if somebody is clean shaven and
he's not
closely cropped, he might be the eccentric.
That's right.
The thing about it. Well, but I'm really optimistic about it. I think that we're going to, and you talk about the micro wilderness. Now we're trying to save small patches of wilderness. Right up at Marina on St. Croix there's a family there that has two fairly good sized lots. Well, about one fourth of this is left in its natural state. They won't put a rake in there even. They want the leaves to fall and they want the flowers to bloom and so forth. And these small wilderness areas are becoming quite intriguing to people. They see the seasonal processes, the turnover and one thing another, and they're beginning to take places throughout the country where they have a surface mine coal. And they are beginning to put those back into natural areas again. In fact, they're compelling them to almost by law. And so here and there, I think there's a kind of a creeping intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
it isn't too apparent, but it's there.
Well, your words are encouraging, Cal, which leads me to another chapter. Describe burning bridges behind us and what you have in this chapter.
Well, what I have reference to there, of course, is the fact that not only many young people, but even executives now are trying to escape from what has been a kind of almost a serfdom of industrial confinement, tensions, and all these sort of things. People are trying to escape. They don't know just what to do about it, for the simple reason that they go to the cities in the hope of making more money, and they make more money in the cities as a rule. But they find that they are captives. They are economic captives. They have to maintain a certain standard of living. They have to have two cars and two dogs and a cocktail bar and the whole thing, you see. And they have discovered that there is a certain frustration about this. And one of the movements toward the suburbs is a manifestation of this sort of thing. And the hundreds of thousands of youngsters walking along highways in the summer trying to get away from it. And the young people who no longer want to follow want to fill the shoes of their father's industrial and business enterprises. This escape element and communes are beginning to pop up here and there and so forth. Now, many of these things can be seriously criticized as a way of life, and I criticize them too. But it is no longer a business and industrial obsession. They are beginning to think that there's a life beyond just 5 or 6 days of hard grind. And the Indian, you know, he says, why don't you work longer than you do, he says, and maintain a different kind of a life. Well, he says, I maintain a good life right now, he says, and I only work a very short time. And they think of the Indian as lazy because he won't work 5 or 6 days a week. But actually, he'll just work long enough to get the necessities of life, and then he'll take off. And this is why they've, of course, been labeled frequently as being lazy.
Cal, I know that you have definite thoughts on politics. You have definite thoughts about other things that involve all of us. There have been some cutbacks to the farmers on the allotments and aid that was unexpected from the president. How about conservation? The president, I think, did he cut back, I think, on some conservation fund?
Well, of course, the whole thing is an industrial and environmental battle. The president has tried to reduce taxes, as is ostensibly anyway, reduce taxes, so he cuts back on the money that should be spent for pollution. And this is very tragic. I would like to point out some basic things about the biography of great men. Abraham Lincoln certainly didn't get great because he tried to save a dollar and let the area be polluted. Abraham Lincoln didn't get to be a great man because he cut back on the poor man's way of sustaining himself. And you can go all the way down the line. I would like to even convey to the President of the United States at this time, if he expects to see some kind of an attitude toward him in the future, that he better start correcting some of these things, because just saving money for the average individual's greed, letting pollution take over and letting the farmers suffer in his field just to save a dollar. Now, I am thoroughly in agreement with Mr. Nixon in wanting a very strong military force, but I would be willing to sacrifice a little money on that side to see that the farmer got some kind of a break, and see that the poor man got some kind of a break, and that racially people got some kind of a break, and that pollution got some kind of a break, and that education got some kind of a break. It looks to me that the people who are going to write write the biography of President Nixon right now, we are going to have a great deal of trouble of making a magnanimous individual out of him.
It was a statement I heard once that the only true wealth is health. And I think if we look at a healthy environment, then we've got it.
Well, the thing about it is that I believe that some of these things that he's doing now, he feels very sincere and conscientious about. But maybe something went to his head on this thing. He got to China by a ping pong game. China opened up the door, of course, for him, and they opened up the door for the ping pong people, and then they invited Mr. Nixon to China, and this is fine. There was nothing, no objection to that at all. I'm glad that he went. And then since he went to China, and China and Russia are in a kind of a dirge here, he went to Russia too, and of course this has all the aspect of the president trying to make an internationally sound program out of it. But he should not get credit to live on for the rest of his existence on these two things alone, unless he develops some magnanimity for every man, woman, and child in the country. I think that he's going to be one of those presidents who nobody reads about.
Cal, the book Once Upon a Wilderness, again, to sum it up as to what the book is, it takes in, it's the wilderness, it's the urban life, it's everybody, isn't it?
The whole pattern. Now, if people think it's just a book on the wilderness and they are not particularly interested in the wilderness, then, of course, they would mistake. This is a pattern. This is the urban side of the thing. This is the wilderness side. This is a suburban. This is life. And it's just a question of how you're going to approach the future in a natural way. How you're going to take the forces of nature and apply them to your existence so that we can continue to survive as a race.
I enjoy the book because there's lots of pictures. You do, you have 60 photographs.
There's about 60 illustrations, and people get a little more intimate approach to the subject, I think, when they can read and then come to a picture, and this depicts the subject too, of course.
Cal, where will the book be available in this area?
The book will be available in all bookstores. In fact, we even have international circulation on all of the other 8 books that we have, and I suppose we'll have it on this one. But they'll be in any bookstore in the city, and they will also be in bookstores here, even locally. They'll be what's the name of these two bookstores here?
We have the St. Croix.
They're changed slightly.
Well, there's the Antiquarian
Antiquarian bookshop. And then there's the Valley Bookstore. They will have these books as soon as shipment arrives, and they should arrive within a day or two if they're not there already.
Your last book was entitled, and see if I get this, A Greenhorn?
Greenhorns in the Southwest. Yeah, this is on the Southwest.
How did the book? How was it received by the public?
Well, it's quite critical, and it's a question of showing the Southwest in both the bad light and in the good light, and where you criticize an area, right? You
get hear into from
a
them
little trouble. Yeah.
Do you hear from them really?
Oh yes.
Yes.
Oh,
no doubt.
I get letters that I wonder how the thing escaped catching fire. It's
so
hot.
Is that a fact?
And then I get very complimentary letters too. Of course, and this is a good thing because it gives you a review, a kind of a personal review of what you write. You know.
Another old saying, I guess, is show me a politician that everyone likes, and I'll show you a politician who never did anything.
Yeah,
because you can't satisfy them all.
That's right. And you got the old saying is you got to step on a few rungs to get to the top of the ladder.
Very true. Well, it certainly has been enjoyable having you with us again on Wavin' Radio. That was about a few years back now. I think Roger Erickson was around here and some of the others, but you had a weekly commentary program on Wavin'.
Yes, and this was a kind of this was a kind of a bombshell every week too.
What type of things did you discuss?
I suppose I am kind of a rebel in many ways. The thing to do is to tell people exactly what they want to hear. If you want to,
well, then they'll love you.
They'll love you. If you speak out, there's a great many people who won't love you. I just noticed here a short time ago that my great-grandfather was the real rebel in Sweden when he tried to separate the church from the state.
Oh.
And he even established a colony in Pennsylvania called Sugar Grove. I don't know whether it's still in existence or not. But if he had spoken out in favor of the church in the state being allied, why, he would have been in trouble. But he wanted everybody to think for himself and pursue whatever persuasion that they wanted.
Well, you're a man of many interests, as I said at the beginning of our program, and we're again indebted to you for coming in and being with us, Calvin Rutstrom. And look for the new book. You should see it within maybe even today on some shelves, but over these next days ahead, Once Upon a Wilderness. And thank you for being with us, Calvin.
I appreciate your having me.
We'll be looking forward to having you with us again another time, and possibly not then to talk about a new book. We'd like to have you back right away. It takes time to write a book. And we'd like to have you back soon.
Thank you.